Good morning to you all on this magnificent day. You're all very welcome to Sunday service at St. Stephen's Green Unitarian Church in Dublin. And you are welcome whether you're here in the congregation with us, or whether you're watching on webcam, or whether you listen to the podcast at some later stage. Our congregation is quietly proud that we have had Sunday worship and a celebration of divinity in the tradition of Unitarianism in this church for the past 160 years. My name is Aidan O'Driscoll, and I am a member of the congregation. We also have a tradition here of an open pulpit, where every 4-6 weeks a member of the congregation volunteers to lead or to take a service. It adds some new voices, some new ideas to the service, but also gives our minister the possibility for a much-needed rest. An opening prayer. Come into this place of peace and let its silence heal your spirit. Come into this place of memory and let its history warm your soul. Come into this place of prophecy and power, and let its vision change your heart. Life is a gift for which we are grateful. We gather in community to celebrate the glories and the mysteries of this great gift. We'll now have our first hymn, number 26, Holy, Holy, Holy. Let us pray. Lao Tzu was a Chinese philosopher in the 6th century BC and is regarded as the founder of Taoism, and both its philosophy and religion. Here is a prayer text, a prayer attributed to him. It is entitled The Tao. Before creation, a presence existed, self-contained, complete, formless, voiceless, mateless, changeless, which yet pervaded itself with unending motherhood. Though there can be no name for it, I have called it the way of life. Perhaps I should have called it the fullness of life, since fullness implies widening into space, implies still further widening, implies widening until the circle is whole. In this sense, the way of life is fulfilled. Heaven is fulfilled. Earth is fulfilled. And a fit person is also fulfilled. There are four amplitudes of the universe, and a fit person is one of them. People rounding the way of earth, earth rounding the way of heaven, heaven rounding the way of life till the circle is full. Let it be so. We will now read the church's covenant, which is printed in the back of our hymnal. We'll read it together. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest for truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine. Our reader this morning is Janet.
Morning, everybody. For today's reading, I'm dipping into one of my favorites. I've read from it quite a few times before. It's titled The Poetry Pharmacy, and it's by William Seagart. It's a book that attempts to treat conditions with a few lines and with poetry. Today's condition that is being treated is the condition of judgment. It might be a little bit harsh, but it's worth listening to. And before I continue, I would say that I consider myself the most judgmental, and that if it was an Olympic sport, I would be a national treasure. No doubt. Anyway, judging others. Thinking ill of others is a heady drug. In the moment, it can make us feel powerful, more virtuous, as though we were the arbiters of our world. In the longer term, however, picking away at others can take its toll on us. For one thing, it tends to be the characteristics that we most loathe in ourselves that we love to criticize in those around us. Niggling away at those things in others allows us to distance ourselves from our own perceived fault. In Elegance, Hafiz offers us a wonderful remedy. When we want to improve our behavior, we often launch ourselves at it, armed only with determination and a mantra. But determination wanes, and mantras soon become hollow words. Without the support of a mentor, all the good intentions in the world may be too little to carry us. Finding a person whose behavior we admire is a much surer route to improving ourselves. For, as Aristotle knew, it is only through learning to mimic the behavior of others that we can cultivate a habit of goodness. So find somebody wise and generous, with an elegance of spirit that you would like for yourself. Tell them why you admire them, embarrassing as it may feel. Ask them for help in being like them. Even when you are not with them, ask yourself, what would they do? Then try to alter your own behavior accordingly. It's a sort of what would Jesus do principle, only with a living guide you can text for encouragement. Soon, you will find yourself treating others with greater kindness in action as well as in thought. Odds are, you'll end up bringing that same kindness to your own insecurities too. And a lovely poem titled Elegance by Hafiz. It is not too easy to stop thinking ill of others. Usually, one must enter into a friendship with a person who has accomplished that great feat himself. Then something might start to rub off on you of that true elegance.
Thank you for coming up and sitting. It makes the telling of the story a lot easier. Now, my story is about the most famous puppet in the world. He's called Pulcinella, and he lives in Naples in Italy. Now, have any of you ever been at a puppet show? And do you remember the names of the puppets? Fantastic. We have somebody from Naples, so she'll be able to check on the veracity of the story.
Performing on the street sometimes. Yeah, and I remember when I was little, one invited me up to stand on the top of a bridge. It was very funny.
Fantastic, yeah. Well, it's a lovely city, isn't it? Very busy, yeah. In fact, the story is a bit about its busyness. But have you ever heard of Punch and Judy? The puppets, the famous, they're kind of a... Well, Punch is actually a relative of Pulcinella. Originally, about 400 years ago, somebody called Punchinella came to London to perform as a puppet, and they shortened it to Punch. So Punch and Judy they're related, but really the godfather of all the puppets is Puccinella. In fact, I have a little this is a little tourist. This is what the face of Puccinella would look like, and you can see he has a distinctive mask. Yeah. His character, he's a sort of an everyman. I mean, he's good, but he's also bad. He's really like just the rest of us. But the main thing is, if you've ever seen a Punch and Judy show, everyone is laughing. And, you know, when you're watching the Puccinella shows, the people are laughing. So the role of the puppet really is to bring some laughter into the world and perhaps make us look at ourselves in a slightly different light. Now, my particular story is that that Puccinella was working hard in a puppet school in Naples, but he was getting a little bit fed up with everyday work, and he decided he'd go on walkabout. So the title I had for the story was Puccinella Goes AWOL. AWOL means absent, without leave. So one evening after the show, he decided he'd walk out into the city. And it's a pretty frightening city in many ways, particularly at night. And but anyway, he enjoyed it. He looked all around the place. And we have to do a little bit of pretense here, because Puccinella can see, he can hear, and he can sort of, in these conditions, he can walk. I mean, there is some great puppeteer in the sky who is helping him to do this. But what he can't do is talk. He's very much dependent on the puppeteer, the person who operates the puppet on strings to walk. But we're going to try to take a little bit of license here and imagine that he's walking around Naples. So the following day, having spent the whole night walking around the city, he goes down towards the sea, towards the Bay of Naples, and looks out on the islands and looks up at Mount Vesuvius. And he's really enjoying himself. But by the end of the day, having walked all over the place, it's a big city, he kind of had enough, and he wanted to go back to his puppet stage. But, of course, he was lost, totally lost. It's a big city. He didn't know how to get back. And he had the added problem is he couldn't talk, so what would he do? What do you think he might do? Would anyone have any ideas about what he might do?
He might just try and retrace the steps. Like, try find where he's been.
Okay, so he might try and go back over his steps. Yeah, he could, but that's quite a challenge. And, anyone else any ideas? Yeah.
Find anyone who knew where he lived. A new side?
Yes, he would. But wouldn't the problem there be, how would he talk to the person? Somebody might sort of recognize him. How could he explain that he's lost and he wants to go back to his puppet shop? Using sign language, yeah. Yeah, why not?
What if he goes into a forest and then comes back into a hut but then gets back to the puppet place?
That's very good English, the two of you are using. Retrace his steps.
How he got lost.
Yeah. Okay. Well, he actually had good fortune, because another tradition of Naples and many cities in the south of Italy is that when somebody dies, they don't, you know, put it in RIP Naples or anything like that. They put little posters on the wall explaining who the people were and who their relatives were and what the information about the ceremony. And there's a big tradition of this, so people are used to studying these posters. And the puppeteer who sort of owned Puccinella came up with the idea of printing a little poster with missing and the picture of Pulcinella on it. And he arranged for his workers to put these posters all over the city. And the following day, the second day after he left, he was walking around and he stumbled on one of these posters and he recognized himself. Now, the problem was he couldn't explain to anybody who he was or what he wanted. As you said, he would like to go back to his theater. So he stood by the poster, and lo and behold, the poster had reward. And a woman came along, spotted him as Pulcinella, saw the reward, and picked him up, brought him back, and both parties were happy. The woman got a reward, and Pulcinella was back happily working in his theater in the old part of Naples. So, what do you make of all of that? Do you think there's anything we could learn from it?
Make sure not to go wandering. Like, just like, you know, be happy where you are.
Be sure not to go wandering, be happy where you are, yeah?
Be happy what you have got.
Be happy with what you've got. Yeah, yeah. But he works very hard and he just wanted a bit of time out, you know?
Make sure to know where you're going before you leave.
And how do you know, how do you arrange that?
Maybe buy a map.
Excellent. Buy a map, yeah.
Try not to get lost.
Well, it's not that easy. Yes, try not to get lost. But people do get lost, and it can be very frightening. I think it's buy a map, and maybe if even we were clever, I would say, you know, buy Google Maps and bring a mobile phone with you. I'd get a compass, yeah. So anyway, the story has a happy ending, and I think we've learned something from it. We now have our next hymn, number 77, Seek Not Afar for Beauty. My own reading this morning is a piece I recently read by Colm McCann, the Irish writer, 35, 40 years ago when he was a young man. He cycled across the United States on a bike, and he wrote this piece. It appeared in a newspaper a week or two ago, and I thought it would be suitable for us to engage with this morning. It's called The Church of the Open Road. I was on the road to nowhere. On the map, I kept to the blue highways. At night, I slept in a tent. I thought myself as an apprentice Kerouac. Gone, Ireland. Gone the strictures of Catholicism. 21 years old, the deepest faith I had was in what might appear around the next corner. In the South, I grew to like Sunday mornings. The churches were open even for sinners of a Catholic persuasion. I was a hungry lad, putting miles underneath my wheels. The picnic tables at the backs of the churches were nearly always full. Pan-fried chicken, brisket, cornbread, iced tea, sweet potato pie. South Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama. The plates filled. The corners turned into other corners. I hesitated a little outside the Louisiana churches at first. Thibodeau, Uma, Morgan City, These were different worshipping places from those I had grown up in. They were smaller, more intimate, with no baptismal fonts, no stations of the cross, no Jesus on the crucifix. I ventured south and stepped inside a small wooden structure near Cameron City on a Wednesday afternoon. The pastor lived out back. I was given a pew to sleep on for an impending storm. I had the sense that in these churches, the people wanted me to convert or be saved, but I had no idea what they wanted me to convert into or to be saved from. The whole idea that my soul should be rescued seemed anachronistic, given that the territory I was cycling through seemed more than enough saving grace for me anyway. I liked the wildness, and my joy was in change. Strangers confided in me. I took their stories and kept going. I was comfortable not knowing where I might be sleeping. I was reading poetry, not theology. I didn't want or need another home for whatever faith I hadn't yet shaped. I went west into Texas. At night, I began to have a little quarrel with God under the bullet hole stars. What exactly did I believe in? Who were these people who were opening their doors? What did I mean to them beyond the fact that I was some lost soul? How could I achieve a sense of personal scripture? I decided that the Church of the Open Road would be my thing. Now, he goes on to recount a number of experiences that he had on the road. He has a fairly freaky experience being baptized in a mega church in Amarillo, in a small town, Independence, in Texas. He starts working on a Southern Baptist-run farm for kids, most of whom were coming out of struggling families or juvenile detention. And he says here, Miracle Farm sharpened my questions about God and action and belief and belonging. And there he met someone who became quite a close friend to him. He refers to him as a half-brother, half-counselor. He was a solid Christian, but decidedly not a holy roller. This man asked him, "Did you ever hear the story of the woman at the well?" "I had, but I hadn't really, not truly, not carefully. And it was there, under a series of new stars, that I began to realize that I wasn't really on the road to nowhere at all. The woman at the well," he told me, "leaves her jar of water behind when she discovers something greater to live for." "You're a storyteller," his friend told him, "and you're a listener. The God you want will be in the people you meet on the road, not in a building." I figured out he was right. The God I needed became articulate in the stories that people wanted and needed to tell me as I rode through their lives. 6 months later, I crossed the Golden Gate Bridge in California with the understanding that faith begins with the inclination to listen. The world was the story of everyone else. For me, it was only just beginning. Colin McCann. We will now have a short prayer leading to some moments of reflection. And the silence will be concluded with some music. Consider that your task here on earth is to try and lead an authentic, worthwhile, and decent life. In so trying, consider that you might embrace a determined optimism. And during your days on earth, consider that the divine will assail you, whether in the joy of a small kindness, the flight of a bird, a Gregorian chant, or in the quiet doubt of the trier. My address today is entitled, Let the Divine Assail You. It asks you to consider the interconnection between the divine and the ordinary, between the eternal and the everyday, between the sacred and the secular, between the numinous and the normal. Exploring this connection, it argues, brings benefit both to one's spiritual life and to the mundane practicalities of just living. Put more simply, we may discover and experience the divine in our daily tasks, while in turn our real world labor may become enriched and guided by the divine. But first, two stories. My rite of confirmation when I was 13 was an event I remember well. In the Church of St. John the Baptist in Black Rock, County Dublin, we boys assembled to be each asked a question about our knowledge of the faith and be confirmed by a bishop of the diocese holding an impressive crozier. As my turn for questioning approached, I stared downward in an anxious way. After I answered the bishop's question correctly, I glanced up at this tall, stern, distant man. As he moved on to the boy beside me, I wondered what would have been my fate had I failed to answer the question he asked me. What was the fourth commandment? While I have fond memories of the day, the bishop, I feel now, belonged with the gods of dispassion and severity. My other story took place also in a church. Just recently, I've had the opportunity to visit St. Patrick's Chapel, College Chapel, on Maynooth University campus. Completed in 1891 and used by the seminarians and priests of St. Patrick's Pontifical University, it must be one of the most beautiful places of worship in Ireland, an outstanding masterpiece of architecture and design. The chapel contains 454 carved choir stall seats, making it the largest of its kind in the world. There is a magnificent rose window and much wonderfully crafted ornamentation throughout. My abiding impression is of a pre-Raphaelite tone of lightness, colour, and emotion. And the eyes are continually drawn upwards to the soaring 21-metre-high ceiling, painted in exquisite and storied detail. I was truly spellbound in awe. So where do we look for the divine? Where does our God reside? Where is eternity? If asked, many people might look upwards to the skies and the stars. Others, perhaps of a gloomier disposition, might look downwards to the supposed place of our biblical God's nemesis. The search is somehow up, down, vertical, structured, ordered, and exclusive. So today I wonder, is it possible to engage with religion and the search for the spiritual, not so much in a vertical, up, down way, but in a more horizontal, organic, back and forth, inclusive manner? In other words, let us see the divine and the everyday as closely interwoven. Let us find and experience the divine in our daily tasks. Equally, these real-world tasks become enriched and deepened by the divine. What is everyday can also be eternal. The French philosopher, mystic, and political activist Simone Weil declared, "To be always relevant, we must speak eternal things." To understand this deep and, I believe, meaningful entanglement, it is beneficial to define what we mean by divine. We come together in a free-thinking church with a liberal theology. Most of us are happy to define the divine across a wide spiritual spectrum. The divine should, I quote, include multitudes, to borrow Walt Whitman's phrase. So we engage with the divine, with God, whatever you consider him or her to be, and we encounter the profoundly spiritual in many ways and spaces. In a church or a house of worship, but also, of course, in nature with its beauty and mystery, with music, art, and literature, but also in the daily and often messy business of just living our human lives. We observe, experience, or perhaps practice acts of kindness, compassion, and mercy in our everyday labor. We witness deeds of suffering, alienation, cruelty, but we also see feats of struggle, redemption, and forgiveness. And all of this in the wondrous project of just living our ordinary daily lives. To pray, to reflect deeply, to contemplate, to have a meditative silence, to ponder the transcendent, to be simply astonished, to be troubled, to be angered. During these moments where the everyday and the divine entangle and connect, can give us renewed meaning and belief in our lives. On such occasions, we can have profound and useful insight and experience feelings of gratitude, of hope, of healing, and of good intention. We can sense a call to reset our way ahead, a call to action, a call to do better. The insight and experience may be reinvigorating and transformative. It may help us to try and lead more worthwhile and decent lives. Perhaps in that moment, we can speak of a connection, a communion of the everyday and the divine. Consider there may be some divine not up there or down there or out there, but within us. Consider there is divine within each of us. I remind you of the words of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, the French Jesuit priest and theologian. We are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. Teilhard de Chardin was also a paleontologist. Paleontologists explore a vast range of ancient life forms, from microscopic organisms to colossal mammals. This field intertwines geology, biology, chemistry, and ecology to reconstruct the evolution of life over billions of years. Teilhard de Chardin applied this evolutionary understanding of the universe to spiritual life. He came to see the origin and purpose of human life, not just the result of a single long past act of creation. Rather, he perceived human life as participating in an ongoing process of creation, a co-creation of the human and divine. I quote Teilhard de Chardin. By means of all created things, without exception, the divine assails us, penetrates us, and molds us. We imagined it as distant and inaccessible, when in fact we live steeped in its burning layers. I'll repeat those two lines. We imagined it as distant and inaccessible, when in fact we live steep in its burning layers. The divine assails us. Teilhard de Chardin contended that humankind is actively partaking in an ongoing process of becoming, a continuing journey of growth in human consciousness, understanding, and knowledge. Again, I quote Teilhard de Chardin. We are not spiritual defenders. We are spiritual explorers in pursuit of greater spiritual knowledge and understanding. In his wonderful address in this church last October, entitled What Is, Is, Frank Tracy spoke to us of Teilhard de Chardin and of the interwoven relationship between the natural world and the supernatural world to be found in Celtic Christianity. Now, if you weren't present at Frank's address on the day, I urge you to listen to it in podcast, and it's also reproduced in the January of this year's edition of Uskult, which is also available online. I thought it was a very profound and helpful address. Frank quotes St. Columbanus, a 6th century Irish missionary. All of life, all of nature, pulsates with the life force of creation. And there is nowhere where the Creator is not. This conception of a divine presence in all creation and of humans actively participating in an ongoing process of becoming helps, I believe, to navigate a faith contradiction that many feel is present in the Christian church. On the one hand, we have the person, and for many also the God, of Jesus Christ, who speaks of the need for boundless love and compassion, and who identifies strongly with the poor and the marginalized. On the other hand, the conventional church and the official dogma present us with a God who is often distant and afar, if not dispassionate and severe. So we may choose to pray with the God above, but we may also choose to pray with the divine within. Taoism, as a religion and a philosophy, also embraces this meaningful entanglement between the natural and the supernatural, between the everyday and the sublime. Harmony, balance, and inclusion all underpin Taoist thinking. It is founded on a belief in the principle of unity of two opposite forces, yin and yang. These forces are seen as opposites yet complementary, constantly shaping the dynamics of the universe. For example, day versus night, the earthly versus the heavenly. Their balance is crucial in maintaining the natural order and harmony. The symbol of Taoism, two tear-shaped forms contained within a circle, each exactly reflecting the other, one white, one black, represents a powerful visualization of this duality. I will read again the opening lines of the Tao, the prayer by Lao Tzu I recited earlier in the service. It captures the notion of creation as a continuing process of becoming, of shaping and reshaping. Before creation, a presence existed, self-contained, complete, formless, voiceless, mateless, changeless, which yet pervaded itself with an unending motherhood. Moving towards conclusion, I make a recommendation. Visit Brú an the Boyne in the Boyne Valley of County Meath, the Bend in the Boyne, and its wondrous passage tombs of Newgrange and Knout. Built over 5,000 years ago during the Neolithic era, these tombs are older than the pyramids, Stonehenge, and the Mycenaean culture of ancient Greece. They are awe-inspiring. While Newgrange is widely known for its solar alignment during the winter solstice, the other site of Knout has even more archaeological and artistic interest. The discovery and excavation of Knout is associated with the distinguished archaeologist George Ogan. In 1968, he became the first person in over a millennium to enter the east side of the tomb at the site. Here, Ogan recounts in a subsequent book his Tutankhamun moment. Before me, in the lamp's beam, was the most amazing sight of my life. What a structure, what a surprise. I had never expected a second tomb in the main mound, let alone such a more impressive one. And having wriggled through some difficult parts in the passage on my way in, my presence alone in the tomb, despite its massiveness, gave me a sense not of isolation, but of security. To conclude, take heed of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. Be spiritual explorers. Let the divine assail you. Amen. We will now have our third hymn, number 123, Spirit of Life. Our notices. Tea and coffee are served below in the Damer Hall after the service, and you're all very welcome, particularly if you are a visitor. And also a reminder that our AGM takes place after the service. We will come up quickly from coffee and start. Gavin has asked me to remind you that our open pulpit remains open, and we ask people to volunteer to lead services over the coming months. At the moment, the 6th of July and the 20th of July are currently open. Gavin has a sheet on which you can add your name and a date. And if you don't have a title for the address, not to worry. Gavin will contact you for that when it is needed. Pam McCarthy leads a weekly service of reflection in the church every Wednesday from 1:05 to 1:35. These sessions can also be accessed via our webcam. Streaming begins at 1:00. It can be a quiet and aspiring time in the middle of your week. The book club will meet during the first week of June. This month's book choice is entitled When Things Come to Light, and the book's author is Liz McManus, a member of our congregation. The walking club has had a successful walk on Bray Head yesterday, and the next walk is scheduled in four weeks' time. Sunday at 2 p.m. is a new initiative here in the church. It is led by the Classical Musicians Network, who meet here in the church and is organized by Shari. Their first hour-long concert is on Sunday, the 25th of May at 2 p.m. Tickets are free, but any donation you wish to be made will go towards our restoration fund. You can get your tickets online from eventbrite.ie. For more information, please talk to Shari. The plant and flower sale, which we postponed, will take place next Sunday, and all proceeds are for Christian aid. Just a reminder that the May edition of Uskult, our church magazine, can be found on the table at the church entrance and is also available online. Finally, a word of thanks for the many members and friends of the congregation who made this service feasible. David for his wonderful music on the organ, Janet for her reading, Therese for the lovely flowers, our welcomers upstairs and downstairs, the tea and coffee crew who will be providing the drinks below, and Ayla, guardian of the church, who ensures all logistics run smoothly. And now we have our final hymn number 29, Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee.
Oh,
closing word. Where hate rules, let us bring love. Where sorrow, joy. Let us strive more to comfort others than to be comforted, to understand others than to be understood, to love others more than to be loved. For it is in the giving that we receive, and in the forgiving that we are forgiven. Amen.
Short prayer, you pray. Yeah.